Welcome back, Badgers, to a wet Badger set, a very wet Badger set here in West Kirby and Hoylake, respectively.
Hello, Bledge. Are you still complaining about this bloody rain?
Yep, always will until the drought comes, which is inevitable, and then I'll complain about that afterwards. So, you know me, miserable Scotsman. But this has been, I'm looking at my rain gauge just now, and it's rising and rising and rising, and I think we've hit 330 mil now since the 1st of January.
This year.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, but
average on these, the Wirral, average in Hoylake, I think is what, like 950 for the year, 900-ish.
Yeah, I think the first year I was here, I think we had about 600. So it's literally, we didn't have anything from my first day here on 31st of January all the way through to May. Pretty much, it was really dry. It was the opposite, and now we've gone the other way. In fact, the seawall in West Kirby breached today.
And people have probably seen videos of that. West Kirby's famous that the council spent 20 million quid, I think, building a big sea defence, and there are cars bobbing around on West Kirby Prom on my Twitter feed.
Yeah, it's pretty rough out there. I mean, we didn't have anyone playing golf today, or everything's flooded again. The water table rises. We don't have a drainage system that can anywhere near handle the amount of water that's coming up and down. And it's time to take stock and think about the future. But we
789. That's the 25-year Hoylake average.
Is it? Oh wow! Yeah. Did you just Google that whilst?
No. One of our members, who is your great friend, the great diplomat, is one of the.
My neighbour.
Mr. Schoen, yes. He's had a little weather station in his garden since 1995, which is pretty good going, isn't it? So
he talks in inches, though. He comes down to my house and talks in inches. And I'm like, Anthony, you need to change your style.
I had to convert it. So do you want to know what the wettest, do you know what the wettest years that we in the last 20, whatever that is, 25 years?
Hit me. 30 years.
So obviously last year was a big one. But 2019 was worse. That was over 1,000 mil in 2019. Mm-hmm. 2012, over 1,000 in 2012. Then going back, look at that. 2000, 1,023. So that was the highest. But what I did a bit of looking around. So
1,000, we've had 1.2 last year.
It reckons.
Yeah, recorded.
You need to go and take it up with Anthony. Yeah,
we've had this discussion. You see, he's seen my fancy weather station, and for any greenkeepers out there, we're sporting a Tough Rewards Davis Vantage Pro 2, and I got the upgraded software so I can get it through my phone. And when Anthony's seen my fancy weather station, he said, "Oh, by Jove, there's actually no point in me keeping this bloody record anymore, is there?"
Well, what it does show, which I thought was particularly interesting, is, you know, there are some years, like look at this, 2012. So in 2012, there was 8 months in 2012 had over 80 mil of rain. Mm-hmm. And that was previously one of the wettest. And then do you know how many months then in 2013, Bledge, had over 80 mil of rain?
One.
So it went from 8 to 1 the following year, and then 3, then 4, then 4. So it's normally about 4, and then occasion. But now, July, August had just under, but let's call it. So July, August, September, October, November, all the way through. So 9-10 months now with big, big rainfall. It's crazy.
A lot of the old school farmers reckon it's a 1 in 50 year thing, but I don't know. We've been working quite close with RNA, looking at all the trends and the graphs, and everything only points in one direction. It's getting more and more and more. Like we always talk about wetter, warmer winters and drier, hotter summers.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, looking at it. Like the overall amount of rain kind of looks the same. I know it's only over 30 years, but it kind of looks the same. But like the big numbers, you know, having this one here that I'm looking at, Bledge, reckons 155 mil in July last year. So you probably got a bit, yours must say 170 or something. But like, if you look, if you take that, even if you take 155 mil in July, I'm looking further back. I'm not seeing a bigger number any time in the year. You know, December, January, February, March, April, whatever. I'm not seeing a bigger number than 155 all the way back until Christ. What's that? 2008. October 2008 had 154 mil. So you've got October 2008 all the way through to July 2023. And there wasn't a month that had.
When do these records go back to? When's the first year he was recording them?
95. January 95.
And how? What are the kind of averages looking like then? Just yearly?
So 720 in 95. 600, 650, 850, 950. This is a nice trend, isn't it? 1,050, well, 1,023, 2,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sort of around the the 850 to 1,000. And then, yeah, the lowest it ever sort of gets down to, looking back through here, is like 580. That was 2011, had 580.
To drive.
But the, so 2006, if you were, people remember that being a particularly dry year. When Tiger won here, we had 12 mil of rain in that July, apparently. But that was 740 overall. Mm-hmm. There was a wet October and December. But yeah, the frequency, the big numbers, and really wet sort of autumns, they do seem to be increasing with regularity for sure.
Well, there has been for us one every cloud, really, every cloud, pun intended. All the new work we did on the new hole, I've never seen turf stitch in as fast. To be able to grow in a new bit of work in the spring is quite difficult, especially with the history. It actually can be quite dry here. I mean, to get that the hole kind of changed and ship shape and all done, and in play actually is pretty remarkable. So that has been pretty good. But we wanted to kind of talk about, and I know we talked about it in the last episode, but especially with Augusta on this week, and all these members of Parkland Golf Courses are going to be tuning in and watching the beautiful, pristine, lovely, manicured, perfectly moisturized turf of Augusta. And then they'll be getting another email from their BRS saying course closed again, no buggies, fifth hole is a par three, that kind of thing, you know. And I feel terrible for these guys and girls, and yeah, just spare a thought if you're a member, a frustrated member, spare a thought for your greenkeeper this time of year, because they are having a nightmare, a lot of these guys, and it's no fault of their own. Everyone's trying so hard, and they want to get courses opened on restrictions, and sometimes roping places off just so you can get golf actually makes things worse, because they're directing traffic to the same bit, and people are desperate to come out. They've got bad backs, they can't use carry bags, or want to use trolleys, or want to use buggies. And I mean, I took the mick out actually of one of our golfers the other day, Hornsby. Actually, he wasn't, you think maybe he was playing golf in Japan, but for a change, he wasn't. He was playing a course round at Manchester, and his white shoes were absolutely black. And I said, you know, clean them before you come here. And he says, it's just what it's like in the inland courses. Just
heights of privilege, though. Most people retire their white shoes over the winter months. So, you know, the temerity to show up on any inland golf course in white shoes shows how spoiled he's been at Hoylake.
That kind of sums up Hornsby, doesn't it? Temerity. Is that the right word? He's a temerate person.
Well, absolutely. There's other words beginning with T that you could use as well, but we won't get into
He doesn't listen to this. We can tell him that. He knows he's... Yeah,
but can I actually go one further, Bledge? Because completely agree. You know, I think if anyone is thinking of giving a greenkeeper a hard time over the condition of the course, you know, shows the most ridiculous lack of self-awareness and awareness of everything that's been going on in general. But I actually, you sent a lovely note out this week, sort of talking about what you're doing to the members and just keeping them in the loop and saying, you know, just this really saying, you know, how much rain has fallen and what we're doing and the steps that you're taking to combat it and all the rest of it. But, you know, just to bear in mind that these are just not regular events, not regular rainfall patterns that you're dealing with. But I don't know whether you, Bledge, as a bit of a perfectionist, and many greenkeepers and course managers that I know out there will be sat there thinking, oh Christ, you know, I'm letting the members down, I'm letting the thing, it should be better, I should be doing this, that and the other. They will be looking at Augusta National and going, oh, my course doesn't look like that. And I think that everyone in this industry, we often love it so much that you can be your own biggest critic. But speaking just as a member of our golf club and as a golfer in general, I'd hope that greenkeepers listening to this don't take that approach themselves. You know, give themselves a bit of slack, because there's only so much you can do. You can't work miracles. You're on sands and the course is saturated. Like, that's the bottom line. The rate at which water is leaving the golf course is lesser than the rate at which water is arriving on the golf course. Like, that is just it. You know, there's nothing more that needs to be said. But you are on sand. And if there are, 3,000 golf courses in the UK and about 250, certainly in England, Scotland, Wales, are on the coast, then the vast, vast majority of golf courses are inland and they are not on sand. And not only are they struggling with the same issue of race of water on the course, they've got all of the other things to deal with as well. So I hope that the greenkeepers who do listen to this do cut themselves a bit of slack and don't hold themselves to unrealistic standards and expectations, because I don't think that any normal member of any golf club, you're always going to have some idiots and there's nothing you can do about them, but any normal member of the golf club has nothing but sympathy for the greenkeepers who are trying their level best to make the courses playable, and they don't hold themselves to a, you know, an unrealistic standard, because that's not going to work.
Well, that's good. Well, and it's nice that you say from a member's point of view. We're lucky here at Hoylake with a very kind of educated and well-informed membership, that there's not really many idiots that are complaining. In fact, there's no one's ever complained to me about anything, which is brilliant. But
you're the only one that complains.
I just wanted to put a statement out there just to let people know that what the kind of the script is with our drainage system and what we plan to do to make sure that maybe if this isn't a 1 year event, that we are prepped for it in the future, you know. And it has highlighted certain amount of things in this golf course that I think we could make better. So, we were actually doing not bad there a couple of weeks ago, and then we had a couple of inches of rain, and then it's bonkers for me. And I've seen bonkers, and I know Paul was at Gullen, top of that hill. You know, he's got flooded bunkers, and Christ, if he's got flooded bunkers at the top of a hill, then what hope have we got for the rest of us? So. But a lot of my friends are kind of struggling just now, so my heart goes out to them, especially the guys in the inland courses. And also, while we're talking about that, some really, really bad news. We lost a very tragically a friend of mine, and someone, a lot of guys that are listening to this podcast will know, last week, in Bobby McDougall. So I just wanted to talk about Bobby, Sam. I don't know, I introduced you to Bobby.
It was in Orlando, yeah.
I'm completely devastated about this. Bobby's the same age as me, two young kids. I worked with Bobby in Norway for a season, and he was my deputy at Micklegard. He was brought on by John Coleman. Bobby's dad sadly passed away, who was his hero. You know, his dad was the course manager at Royal Mid Surrey. Bobby absolutely idolised him, and he just really wanted to be a brilliant greenkeeper, and he was fantastic. And then he left the greenkeeping industry, and he worked with Infinicut, he worked with Suitors, and he worked with Aitkins, who I do a lot of business with, Aitkins. Just all of a sudden there, Bobby took really unwell, and we never got to say goodbye. But my last amazing memory was in Orlando, in the Howl at the Moon, where I introduced Bobby to Jenny, my wife. And I could see them, like, Bobby was hammered. I mean, he loved a drink. He was a great singer, Bobby. He was in a band called Nocturne Wolf that were like a kind of Metallica type band. He had a Metallica tattoo on his top of his arm, and he was just right into it. He was hilarious with it, and he would have been a great front man. I really wish he'd seen his band, but him and Jenny hit it off at the bar, and they were just, she was like, "Oh, I've met this guy tonight. He was hilarious. What a laugh." And I was like, "Is it Bobby?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, Bobby. What a bro." And then we'd seen him the next day in the show, and he was rough. And that was my last kind of proper memory of him, because obviously he didn't make Harrogate this year. But if any of you guys, girls that are listening to this podcast that knew Bobby, then it's been a hard couple of weeks, and it's his funeral on Monday. So I'm going to head up to that, and it's going to be a tough one. But yep. Where's his
funeral
pledged? In Clydebank. I've got the address. It's way up Glasgow, yes. So a tough one, old Bobby. But I'm sure knowing him, there'll be a couple of Metallica songs probably played at it, you know. So
wow.
IP Bobby McDougall. Good lad.
Tragic. But again, it really, really shows everything that people think about and think people are worrying about. I mean, they just pale into complete insignificance, don't they? There's a lot more important stuff going on in everyone's lives, and that really is. One meeting with him, Bledge, so I didn't know him like you knew him, so I'm sorry for you. No, well, everyone who did know him, it really is.
He told me to listen to the podcast. I don't know whether he was just trying to be a pal, but
yeah, that's what most people do. They just give us a nice platitude. Well, that really is sad news indeed, Bledge. But moving at least trying to some nice things that we've had in recent weeks, and one of those has been the response we've had from you guys, from the listeners who do actually listen to us whitter away and ramble on about the things that we love. And a couple of weeks ago we started encouraging you to write in and send questions, and we talked about some of our ideas for not just guest episodes but also debates that Bledge and I might have, and questions, be they technical detail questions, especially if we can help outsource some of those to friends in the industry who are, you know, world leading agronomists or drainage consultants or whatever. So please keep those coming in. That's hello@golfbadgers.com. We've had quite a few already, and we really do. We've really enjoyed reading all of them. And the other thing is slightly more general, generic questions. If you are new to our little corner of the golfing world and want to learn a bit more about architecture or greenkeeping or whatever, but you know, we talk about things, or you're sort of don't really know where to start. It could be a beginner's guide to X, Y, or Z, whatever it may be. There are no stupid questions. No one's here to judge. You know, I very, very open and honest and transparent that part of my real motivation for doing this podcast in the first instance was so I could learn more about greenkeeping and maintaining golf courses. I think this, if you know, you work in the industry that I do, and you actually help design and redesign and make changes to courses, then someone's got to look after it at the end of the day. And there's a great quote by Harry Colt that said, "The true test of a golf course is, will it last? And if it can't be maintained, then it won't last, and you failed." So I think that really, I've loved being able to learn things from you, Bledge, about your side of the industry, and I hope that over the course of my career, it will make me a better architect. So whatever it is, if you're joining a green committee or just got a growing interest in what actually goes into making these golf courses, then I hope you'll write in and ask about whatever topic it may be, because the reality is that if you're wondering it, then there's going to be 100 other people out there wondering it as well. So thank you for all of those that have written in. But Bledge, we had a little chat before starting, didn't we? And there was a question that we thought would be a good place to start. We're just going to pick one, but it's an interesting topic. And the premise is basically, what do you do when you start? You know, if that is for you, Bledge, as a course manager, you've moved from club to club. Not many. You've tended to be a good while at places, but naturally people do progress and move around. And I think starting at a course from scratch, let's start with an existing golf course. It's not any course in particular, just an imaginary golf course. Let's say that you, Bledge, have been appointed as the new course manager.
And the Badger Trap.
Badger Trap National Club has appointed James Bledge as its
course manager. It would be a golf and country club if I was going though, Sam. It would have a swimming pool.
I'm sure, and a nice warm climate and no rainfall. So we've got our imaginary golf course, and Bledge has just been appointed. And let's say, Bledge, it's a typical inland golf course, drains well, not full of clay, but it's not necessarily on sand, but it's reasonably drained. It's got trees. Mm-hmm. It's on 120 acres, some houses around and about, and it's somewhere in a beautiful little English town somewhere, and it's 100 years old. So. Mm-hmm. You've got the job, you're rocking up day one. I would love to know what your first day, your first week looks at. How do you get to know what you're inheriting, course, staff, equipment, everything?
Well, I would say in your first weeks, and not plural actually, because it takes quite a while, but you really want to be spectating. You are hopefully turning up, and I know at the Badger Trap they've got a fantastic deputy, so you can leave them up to it, and just actually watching how the team work, watching who's good at what, getting around the team, and because that's the most important part. If you don't have your team, then you're kind of screwed from the start, you know, and if you can't have a rapport with them, then you're even super screwed. But the meeting everyone and finding out their good points or bad points, how they work, what they enjoy doing, what they don't enjoy doing, and how the team dynamic works as well. I think this is the single most important thing. And then you can start to move on to looking around to see where they can make small improvements and noting them, but like not necessarily implementing them straight away, because I guess you don't really want to be going in from day one, week one, week two, and starting to kind of say, no, maybe we should do this better or that better. You need to kind of just sit on your hands for a little bit before you even, because they might do things a certain way for a certain reason that you don't know about, that's horses for courses. So I think that's just keeping quiet in the background is the sensible thing to do for that. And you want to start to kind of get to know the membership, how you like to be communicated with, and knowing suppliers, having people come in that kind of, because your people that supply you with, whether it be fertilizers, chemicals, machinery, these guys are so, so important, because you really need, the team is not just you and your greenkeeping team. I consider my team to be my contractors, the people who I buy machinery off. God, even like this week I've had these new range boards made, and now I would consider Birkenhead Powder Coaters and Diamond Precision Engineering part of my team, because I will use them again for stuff. And this is a phone number now, and the nicer you are to these people.
They do look great. They do look great. Why don't you just a little self-indulgence, Bledge, because where did you get the inspiration for those? Where did you see them from?
Well, when we were in Phoenix, Arizona this year, lucky enough to play with a member of Royal Cinqports called Stephen Lyons, took us up to Troon Country Club, beautiful, beautiful golf course up in Scottsdale, and walking on the range, you know, and to any Greens chairman listening to this or secretaries, I cannot recommend enough your golfers, your course managers, etc., playing other golf courses, because that's where you get all your ideas from. I steal, and like I said in that tweet earlier, when I used to write music with a band, I played in a rock punk band and the punk rock band, and I used to just steal riffs mainly from Mike Venner from Ocean Size, and then put them all together and make another song, which I'd take to the band. And that's, I've forged a whole career out of stealing stuff, Sam. Stealing ideas, stealing templates for Word documents, templates for Excel sheets. I've never done everything on my own. I've designed little bits and pieces, but that's always been, you've got to be inspired by something. And then I walked on the range Troon and saw this amazing board that was a range board that said the yardages to every flag out in the range, and there was little partridges, which is a club logo, that were coloured, and I thought, well, I'd love to get something like that made. And I contacted our suppliers across here, and none of them could really do it. So I thought, well, we'll make it ourselves. So when I say ourselves, by looking outside of the industry, and I found a fabrication company that just sent them the picture and told them the dimensions or whatever, and drew up the design for them. They cut it all as sheet metal. We got two range signs made for peanuts. I mean, I think I paid 400 quid for them both. And when they were the same for powder coating. So 400 quid each for these signs, which you would have paid. I think you'd have paid 1500 quid for them from Parade, Tasset, Pinseeker, blah, blah. I've probably been struck off by trying to take business off these guys, but sometimes you can't do things and you need to look your own way. So we put them out there this week, and I'm chuffed to bits with them. They're really, really cool. And we went liver birds instead of partridges, which was really nice.
Partridge probably would have suited this podcast, wouldn't it?
We often
reference the Alan Partridge, our great inspiration for our broadcasting style. I just thought of something then. I just Googled it while you were talking, Bledge, and I've got a quote to read back to you. And the quote is, "Almost everything I've done, I've copied from someone else." And the thing that made me think of it is it's a sort of closing the loop, really, on the round of golf that we played together in Phoenix when we played at Whisper Rock, and our fantastic, unbelievable host there. And as a student of entrepreneurship and, you know, love those kind of business things. But do you know who said that quote there, that almost everything I've done, I've copied from someone else? It was the Mantra, the other one. You had a 50-50 guess there.
Oh, the Walmart guy.
Sam Walton. Sam Walton, he didn't invent barcodes, but he saw them somewhere else as an opportunity, and he applied them at scale at Walmart, and they pioneered it. And he didn't invent the concept of a supermarket, but he took, you know, saw the idea and applied it better than anyone else. And, you know, I think people put a lot of value on originality, and yeah, of course, you know, that's sort of what I trade in. It's important, but equally, originality and good ideas are nothing without implementation. And also, if you walk around just trying to reinvent the wheel every day, then you're never going to get as far as if you just jump in your car. You've got to see these things and go, oh, that could work. That could work at my course. How can we do that? And then you've gone out and you found somewhere and supported a local business. Another one that I love, which was one of the very few things that I managed to do on the Green Committee at Hoylake when I was on it a few years ago now, it was before you came, was the little stakes, the yardage stakes
they're brilliant.
Refurbished.
You're right. I mean, given some, there's nothing more sustainable than giving some business locally. So this is what we're
absolutely
to be doing a lot of the time, if we can.
So you've been observing the Badger Chat now for a few weeks. You've got a team of five, you know, fantastic greenkeepers that you've inherited here, Bledge, who are going to make you look much better than you actually are. But you've got a shed that's probably got a leak in the back of it, and you got to get your feel for the machinery that you have. You know, what's the absolute best, you know, the basic things that you need, and where do you start building your machinery for maintaining a golf course like this?
Well, I guess the next thing you really want to be doing is auditing, and that would be auditing everything from your machinery to your stock to your irrigation system. And before kind of doing anything, a really good audit is the first thing. Then you know where you stand, and looking realistic. What do you need? How are you going to pay for it? How well off is a club? You need to plan as to what years you're going to be spending what. Can you do finance? Do you buy outright? I mean, in this day and age, where APRs being so sky high and borrowing money, it's difficult for a lot of clubs to kind of justify paying up to anywhere's up to 10% APR, you know. But the
alternative and is also, the capital cost of machinery now is prohibitively expensive for lots of people, surely. You know, what's
so at the budget trap, I think we don't have loads of money, so we're looking towards good secondhand machinery. And then have you got a mechanic that can maintain that? And is that going to put your actual budget through the roof when it comes to, because the older the machine, the more money you need to set aside in your actual budget.
Yeah, of course. Okay. So you require more ongoing maintenance skill to offset. Mm-hmm. So you might have to, if you don't have that expertise in your team already, then you're probably going to have to outsource that to someone, mm-hmm. and bring an additional cost and play those two off against one another for the optimum source of variation. But what do you need machine wise? You know, you're going to have, are you going to be hankered in greens everywhere, or you know, what's your core machinery that everyone is going to have?
Well, before going on to that as well, I would kind of enthuse that the most critically important part of machinery selection is selecting a good supplier. You might go on there and be a big John Deere fan and be like, ah, you know, I want to kit the whole place out with John Deere. But the John Deere dealership could be 2.5 hours away, and you might have a Jacobson dealer that's 20 minutes down the road. And you might find that Jacobson dealer, and this is just me just using names for the sake of it, but it could be anything. Other companies are available, but the other mowers are available. You might find that they can offer the best support, the best backup machines. They've got better, they can get spare parts over to you fast. So these are all the things that matter, you know, when you are selecting machines. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat a lot of times, and there's so many brilliant machines out there in the market just now, and a lot of people are kind of looking towards secondhand machinery more, myself included. I've actually, I would say I've bought 70% new, no, 60% new and 40% secondhand since being here, probably. Because, I mean, I'm very, very lucky with Phil, our mechanic, who is epic, brilliant, brilliant mechanic, can fix anything. So in that position, I can buy machines that might be a little bit older and make them last a little bit longer, and can save the club a bit of money. And we can direct money towards other things like drainage or irrigation or even staff. So, yeah, I mean, the machinery thing is, crazy. You could talk about that in a whole other episode, you know. I mean, there's so many different variables, picking the right machine for the job, getting the right advice. I mean, we had Tom Stidder in today, self-employed, works for himself, going around all the golf courses, a lot of golf courses in Britain, offering advice to mechanics on cut quality, machinery selection, grinding. He was a top mechanic himself as well, but he's really kind of taken on and be a great person to have on this podcast, actually, because he is the Adrian Mortrum of machinery setup. You know, he's a machinery badger, and I'm sure he would love to, because he loves a chat and loves talking about stuff like this. And I mean, in fact, what time is it now? It's 4:30 just now, and his car's still outside, actually. Him and Phil are still
blithering away.
Yeah, I'm still looking at sole plate angles and all sorts of stuff, you know. And we made some changes today in our fleet, speeds and heights of cut, and as I say, attitudes. The pair of them reckon we've made some good gains. So, yeah, I mean, there's the machinery thing's huge. It really is. And
well, let's save that for a separate deep dive in its own right, and assume that we've got perfect. Well, let's assume that the machinery is up to scratch for the time being, but we're going to get an expert in and complete the audit. What about the course itself? You know, what are the things then that you can do to test, to audit the the composition of the greens, the types of grasses that you have across the site, the drainage, the vegetation? Where do you start with that kind of stuff?
Well, I guess you need to, I mean, during your job interview for that, you would have walked every hole, and you would have probably presented to the board about how you see the course just now and how you see it going forward. And I think realistically you'd have your vision in your head of what kind of grass species and sward composition that you would want going forward and how many years it would take to achieve that. And there's a lot of variables that come in with that. And again, back down to auditing, whether that be auditing your grass species and counting exactly what you've got there, percentage wise, and thinking, right, over 5 years I think I can get to this and that, and what do I need to do that? Do I need to look at my organic matter content, 20, 40, 60, 80 mil, what's happening underneath the soils, how are we looking there, auditing the drainage system, do we have enough drains, how are these drains set out, you know, have I got burn marks in my fairways where they're perforated when they should be solid and vice versa or whatever, you know, it's just because when you're taking over a golf course, I mean, I was very lucky to inherit this place from Craig, who pretty much smashed everything in every section, you know, it was in fantastic condition when I came and everything was kind of set nicely. But just because you're turning up at somewhere, you can't always expect that to be the case. And in a lot of cases, there could be flaws in the irrigation system, the way it was installed. And it's up to you when you take on a new job to kind of investigate all that and make sure, see how it's running, see how the software's running, and even getting deep into the bones of your irrigation software. Is every valve and head, is all the information in the computer all right? Does it, if it's at 180 in the computer, is it actually spraying at 180 out there, or is it spraying more or less? Has it got the right nozzles all the way through? Is everything actually working though when you pop it up? You know, is it gonna, you really need to audit that as well. You know, these are the things that affect the agronomy, and thus they need to be absolutely bob on before you get going. And that's when you make the plan as to how you're going to get there and how long it's going to be. I mean, I've just spent the last month building it was started off as a 7-year plan to take us to 2030, but then I think we changed it to links management strategy, where it covers 8 different subjects, from the agronomy all the way through to the CAPEX, ecology, staff training, what's underneath the greens, the kind of issue, and with some of the greens being a bit claggier and how we're going to deal with that. And that's kind of going to be ready to present to the board. And for me as a course manager at a place like Hoylake, this is something that's imperative to present to the board and get right. You won't ever have any clout if you stand up in a board meeting and just say, oh, I want this and I want that, because then the first thing they'll do is turn around and say, well, what evidence have you got of that? And then I can say, well, do you know, the greens, for example, we have, let's say, 6 plus 6 and 8 greens maybe that were a lot slower during the open and that are softer during the winters and they just take a bit more work. How do I get them to the same standard as the rest of them, you know? And as I say, it's not a case of just saying you want to do it, but if I can dig down and find out what the problem is and get soil samples done and get it all professionally put in front of them at a very small fee, you know, you're talking a couple hundred quid for a particle shape size test and percolation tests, and you're working with a board of members that in most, more cases than not, have their own businesses. They're maybe accountants, or they deal with that kind of a high-end sort of business, that the language they speak in is in facts and figures and well placed out planned documents in front of them, and we need to be able to speak to their language. And this is why we do things at FTMI, and why Bigger do such a great job at Harrogate. We continue to learn by teaching up and coming greenkeepers how to present to their boards. And I think I kind of gone off on a tangent here, but it does actually make sense, because in your first few weeks in a new job, these are the kind of things that you need to be thinking about doing in the coming months. And it's a very stressful time, because you're trying to learn about, I mean, I'm still learning about Hoylake 2 years in, and there's still things I don't know about it. And you always learn about your team. And I mean, this is me making the first kind of big plans 2 years in, but I have been thinking about, I've made smaller ones since the very day I got here, but this is the first big, big impact statement
plan. No, I think that point on data is so important. You know, I always go back and back and to the why. You know, I think why is the most important word. Why do you want to make that change? Why do you want to do this pledge? Why do you want to spend our money? You know, just crack on with what you've got. It was previous guy managed fine. Why do you want to change things? And whether that's coming into a new job, whether that's looking to do any kind of project, significant or minor in your eyes, if you try and stand up in front of these guys and say, yeah, I just want to do this, and they say, well, okay, Bledge, why? And if you try and bullshit that and just don't make a case, this is backed up in by some kind of, you know, we have this problem, we've identified X, Y, and Z, this is our solution, this is how much it will cost, this is what we expect it to, how we expect it to perform differently, this is what it will mean for future maintenance. If you can't answer that, then why should they sign this off? It's not like you want to, because I think that's the point. It's, there is no one who would ever listen to this who would want to make a change for the sake of making a change. There's always a reason behind it. You just got to be able to quantify it. And I think that's so important in every line of work, isn't it? But particularly so on golf courses, when people often get emotionally attached to things when they are the way they are.
And it's a lot of money you're spending. It's members' money that you're spending there. And like, I mean, we're not talking about wanting a couple of grand to do these projects. You know, they're all deep into their five figures, you know, and it goes for, even if you're trying to stand up in front of the board or committee and justify a new rough moor at £100,000, you know, you've got to be well armed with the information to kind of justify that. So, but I guess just like yourself, when you go up to speak to golf clubs about why you want to change their holes, I mean, Christ, if there's anyone that's armed, and I don't want this to sound like to turn into a backpatting session, but if there's anyone that's well armed with data, info, and a load of lovely graphics to kind of back up their
then it's Joe McDonald.
Decision, you and Joe, so
well. Look, it was the second half of the question. It's the reason we started with this one it was sort of both of you. So you two different perspectives when you come into a course, whether that's, in your case, Bledge taking over as course manager, or let's say, Bledge, you've gone to your board, you've been observing for a while, and you want to call up the number one golf course architect in Britain. But you realise they're not available. So so instead you say, oh, well, Sam will be able to do it. He'll do.
Yeah, he'll do a mate's rate.
Yeah, 20% extra. So what's on the other side of the coin? How do you approach it? And it's funny, isn't it? The more places you do, and the more common themes you sort of find. And I reckon 80%, giving away trade secrets here, aren't I? 80% of a course plan.
No one's listening.
Exactly. 80% of a course plan can probably be written. It's probably the same every single place you go. Mowing lines on the fairways, green shapes, bunkers, drainage, vegetation management. You know, you get those things right. And then there are other things, safety, boundaries, how the boundaries change over the times. You know, I said at the start that our imaginary golf course here is about 100 years old. Well, if it was built in 1924, then you can bet anything that quite a few of those holes will run right down the edge of boundaries. But whilst they might have been open fields, you know, I think Harry Colt designed this imaginary golf course in my head, Bledge. So let's say he had, you can bet that they would be designed so that if you played right along the boundary, you were rewarded. You know, you had a good line in, and therefore the fairways would have gone right up to the boundary. The bunkers all would have been placed to challenge the longest hitters of the day, bearing in mind they were the longest hitters playing with hickory golf clubs. And a 1924, they would have been playing with a Haskell golf ball still, but you know, it would have been very different from today's equipment. And the fairways would have been super wide, they would have been big, the tees would have been right next to the greens. So the flow would have been fantastic. There probably wouldn't have been many trees. There certainly wouldn't have been many trees, you know, sort of around the edges of greens or the edges of tees that probably then on your side of things, Blair, go on to affect the agronomy. And that's why, you know, I tongue in cheek say you can go a long way by those five or six things into really, really improving a golf course. It's not rocket science at all. It is, you know, you go to, let's say we've rocked up now and we're walking down the fairways together at our imaginary golf course. And the first thing we see, fairways are 26 yards wide. There's deciduous trees flanking both sides. The bunker is 180 yards off the tee. And the green is so small that it doesn't matter where you're coming in from the rough even. You can still stop your pitching wedge on it, no issues if you're a good player. But, you know, your higher handicap golfer's walked out and he's just caught the lip of that bunker back at 180. Well, you know, it's all wrong. It's all wrong. That is the point. You know, you've got away from what the course was trying to do. So you can't necessarily just reinstate it as it was because that bunker's still in the wrong place. And you can't just necessarily take it up to the boundary because all of a sudden Redrow have built 50 houses in that field that used to be. If you went in there days gone by, that's another thing. You went out of bounds before 1957, and it was a different penalty. It was distance. You hooked your ball out of bounds, you played your second shot from the tee, not stroke and distance, not your third shot from the tee. So all of these things are different, and you've got to try and work within the parameters that exist nowadays, the boundaries, the fact that the golf ball goes so much further, and the fact that there's different expectations. It's 365 days a year that people want to go and play golf around this golf course, not just the summer, because that's another thing as well. You know, waterproofs, good clothing. Who wanted to play golf in the pissing wind and rain in the middle of the British winter 100 years ago? They didn't. They wouldn't have
went out because they played in tweed.
Yeah, it's
smart. They wouldn't get their tweed. Tweed would be heavier. I mean, I've never ever swung a golf club in tweed. My good friend, Lord Simon Cullingworth, who I know that won't listen to this podcast because I don't think he's got any sort of listening device or phone because he's still in 1920. But Simon plays sometimes in tweed, and I can imagine it being pretty restrictive.
Yeah, well, exactly. And if you went into a bunker in years gone by and you were in a crappy lie, then so what? It's a penalty. Get on with it. You know, we've changed. We've, as a culture of golf, we have changed, and it has an impact. I think that there's an interesting podcast series, actually, Bledge, in unintended consequences of advancements, what they've meant to the game. You know, Galvin Green has changed the way that courses are set up, how, you know, the waterproof jacket has changed how golf courses are designed. And they didn't think about that when they were just making a nice jacket, and isn't that great? But now, you know, you've got to think that more people will be playing golf at wetter times of the year as a result, more demand. How do you have bunkers that can survive a deluge of rain, and therefore more likely to be built with a bunker liner and drainage, and care more about particulate size, all of these things? You know, it's the unintended consequences, the knock-on factors that you've got to really think about. So there you go. There's my starter for 10. But the thing that always gets me most passionate is the routing. You know, I always come back to routing. Typically,
so research the routing before you go to a golf course? Like, let's take out the Badger Trap, for example, but let's go to an actual one you've done in the past. Will you get the old Google Earth up before you take the trip up to walk in it for the first time and just do your homework that way? And do you look back through Google Earth to see what it used to look like and stuff? What's your prep like?
You know what? Sometimes, often I'm returning to a course that I've played because I generally work around the coast and I played them all. And I for good or for ill, I have quite a good memory. I can remember every hole that I've kind of played, so I can often remember But I don't think I really would. I actually quite like doing the exact opposite pledge and just going out, walking a course without preconceptions. Because if you look at something just on Google Maps from a routing, then it doesn't tell the full story. You know, even if you've got a great topo map and you're looking at the contour lines, then it doesn't show you the long views behind holes in the distance, you know, the attractive aspects, because that is an incredibly important part of it. We've been working, Joe and I, this morning on a course, well-known course, up in Scotland, and they have a problem par three, and they said, would you rebuild this in the same place? And he said, well, no, for X, Y, and Z. Well, there's 10 reasons why I wouldn't put it in the same place. It was shoved in the 70s and or 80s or whatever. However, you could put it here. And what I love about that kind of puzzle is I think if you change something and it makes the thing that you're changing better, that's not good enough, in my opinion. I think that if you're changing something like the routing, if you're building a new hole, then that's got to change. It's got to be worth more than the sum of its parts. So in that example, by making that change, that hole had been shoehorned between two old holes. Well, I think it made the second hole, the hole that you played after that old par three, it made it worse because you then played the subsequent hole from a worse angle. So by getting rid of it, you reinstate it and you make a hole better straight away. Then you look at the walks between tees, and it just so happens that there are two instances there. I hate walking back. I bloody hate walking backwards from a green to a tee. Sometimes because of championship golf, whatever, it's necessary, like the old course deal would be an example because it's a sort of continuous routing. But if it can at all be avoided, you know, I know it's slightly weird that we as golfers go out for a 3.5 hour walk and we want to walk the shortest possible distance when we do that. But it's true, you know, it's human nature, path of least resistance. And walking backwards is just, you know, to be avoided in my opinion at all costs. Mm-hmm. There were two occasions on that course elsewhere where you had stupid walks, sort of an 80-yard walk that way and a 60-yard walk that way. Well, where we sort of proposed that the new hole could be played, which would be a beautiful hole in its own right, and incorporate now a beautiful view down an estuary, the hole would be better than the hole that replaces, categorically. Mm-hmm. I think that is the case. However, as I say, it makes that hole that was sort of shoved out the way to make space for it previously, that hole is improved. We have now reduced the walk between what is currently a long walk between two holes. We now play a par three in between them, and we slightly lengthen that second hole and create a par five out of a long par four, which I think again is more interesting because the hole that has become a par five, you play, it's got such a good green, you want to play a long club into it. So that hole becomes more interesting. And it just so happens that you move another tee to sort of make space for those tees that shortens the walk and makes the... So I think we've made five holes better by moving one piece. And look, you don't do that everywhere. Of course you don't. But I think always having the objective of a change improving more than the sum of its constituent parts is not a bad starting point. What's the worst hole on the course? What's the worst section of the course? How can you identify that? Is there a problem from boundaries? If you identify those things, how can you turn that from the weakness into the strength? And you know, I think all those things together, that's the job really. And then doing this in a way that you guys can look after and maintain, and hopefully actually makes it easier to maintain the golf course.
People are going to be wondering what course you're talking about now. That'll be your next question.
Yeah, no, I think that's, that's the annoying thing about this kind of line of work, the cloak and dagger. I'm not bothered enough to ever really go in for that line of stuff, but you know, it's people are very, especially when it comes to rooting, you know, I really, really firmly believe that you do not fuck around with a golf course unless there is good reason to do so. And that's why, again, you know, when you were talking about your side of things, justifying change, justifying investment, you're not going out there just trying to make a case because you want to do the work or whatever. But if I can't stand up in front of, you know, like at Southern Ness the other week, we talked about this on the podcast, and there are 120 odd, however many people are in the room, and they sit there, and I'm up front, rabbit in the headlights, and got their arms crossed, and half of them are glaring at me. And you think, oh, Christ, you know, they hate me. They hate everything I've said. I just want to sit down and it's not, you know, up. They get, yeah, exactly. But realistically, if I can't say why you should do this, or they, if, you know, they should stand up and say, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to put, why do you want to get rid of that? Why do you want to move that? Why do you want to do that? If you can't answer the question, then don't do it. You know, I firmly believe that. So I think that it's important to have done your homework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it sounds like, well, it's the kind of similarity in both our line of works where we both need to justify stuff, and it's very important. But it's been a massively interesting conversation, Samuel.
Well, hopefully people will think so. And hopefully people will carry on sending questions, because we've got some great things come in already. So sincerely, everyone who has actually sent a message and sent an email to, can you remember the email address, Bledge?
hello@badgers.
No.
Dot, no.
Screwed it up already. Come on. hello@golfbadgers.com.
Hello@golfbadgers. I forgot we played golf, didn't we?
We don't encompass all badgers. Did you see that bloke on Instagram, by the way, Bledge, who's robbed off our little thing?
Yes. I know. Unbelievable. Well, we kind of did start this.
We need a cease and desist.
By saying that, like, copying is the kind of the highest form of flattery, or whatever. So, fair enough.
Well,
we're the originals, pal. We're the originals.
Let's leave it there before we tie ourselves in knots, and thank everyone for listening, and encourage them to send in more emails, more questions, more topics for debate, because it's great to get more insight into your side of things, Bledge, and really do enjoy these kind of chats.
And I hope that everyone that is opening their golf courses in this coming week, that we do get some drier weather and you all get a break. As I say, even though we are wet, we're sort of one of the lucky ones that we can. I know that we'll be open tomorrow and everything will be all right. But thoughts go out to all you guys out there. So.
And if you're a course manager, cut yourself some slack as well. You know, don't be out there stressing, going, how can we get this water off the golf course? If it can't be done, it can't be done. And no member of your golf club, or at least not one whose opinion is worth ever entertaining, would think otherwise. You know, there are some people who think that you can just snap your fingers and the water disappears. But those are the guys that would complain that it was too sunny or too brown or too dry or too whatever. You know, the 99% of normal golfers out there do not live in a vacuum. They look at their gardens covered in mud and they go and walk the dog in the Wellington boots, and they'll then go to the golf course and they know that you've had the same amount of rain. So that's my genuine sort of point to you, your side of the industry, Bledge. You know, don't hold yourselves to unrealistic expectations, because at some point it will stop raining, and at some point it will get a bit warmer as well, and the grass will grow and you'll be cutting the grass, and everyone will just look back on this and go, Christ, wasn't that bad, but it will be a memory. And yes, there are probably things that we can all do, architects, greenkeepers, everyone in the industry, to try and think about how you can set up courses to be more resilient to rain and climactic change. Maybe that's something that we should have a think about, Bledge, for future episodes. Yeah. But if you can't do what you can't do, so Don't try and hold yourself to those unrealistic expectations.
Excellent. Good word, Sam. Good word. And yeah, we'll see you guys all, or we'll you'll hear from us all in the coming weeks. So thanks very much for listening in. We appreciate all your emails and your feedback. And yeah, we'll see you soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Cheers, bye.